This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the world is watching millions of people being starved to death in real time. It has been about 2.5 months since any food, water, or any supplies have entered the Gaza Strip. On March the 2nd, the regime blocked the entry of all needs from entering Gaza. No international organization or country has stopped the regime from its intentional torture and starvation of the Palestinian people. And this comes along with the consistent murder, bombing, and targeting of Gaza kids, women, and men. Who will stop the genocide against the people of Palestine, and when? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And Tony Goslin, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to the program. Let's start it off with Mick. I mean, it was March the 2nd, Mick, when the regime cut off all food and supplies. But isn't the reality that food has consistently been used as a weapon by the regime targeting Palestinians in Gaza? I mean, since 2007.
Yes, if anyone paid attention, the evidence was there in full view. I can't remember the guy's name, but one of the advisors to the Israeli government, a portly advocate, apparently made a joke in a cabinet meeting that the Israelis were not going to starve the Palestinians in Gaza. They were just going to, quote, put them on a diet. And leaked documents actually revealed how the micro-planning of suffering in Gaza took the form of an actual calorie count, which the Israelis were prepared to allow into Gaza to keep people hungry, but not Biafra-style famine. Now, that's in the past, but the planning of hunger, a degree of hunger, has been very well known for a very long time. Food as a weapon of war is absolutely natural for the Israelis. Now, of course, those cruel phrases are out of date, because they are imposing famine on the people of Gaza. And every agency that knows anything about food and food insecurity and the risk of famine says that of the over 2 million souls in Gaza, 500,000 are in imminent danger of famine. And everyone there is at risk. So yes, your language is very restrained. Every chancellery in Europe, North America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, all the NATO countries plus Japan, etc., they know exactly what's going on. They have intelligence services who tell them that this is famine. For 70 days, all food Israel has tried to prevent going in. And the situation is as public as it can be. And what do we hear from London, Washington, etc.? A deafening silence from officialdom. So it's very clear that all these governments are not any longer complicit in the famine. They're either giving a green light to the famine very clearly, or they're actively involved in it. So, for example, the UK government, their Air Force flew over Gaza over 500 times since October 2023, 500 overflights in which they gave intelligence to the killers below, to the Israelis on the ground. The British Air Force is a full partner in the genocide and in the construction of this famine.
Yeah, well, let me get Tony in on this discussion. Tony, thanks so much for being with us. Now, the rogue Israeli regime has killed Palestinians in any way that it could, from starvation to burning them alive to shooting them while they try to get aid. I mean, is there anything that the regime could do which would cause its Western and Arab backers to interfere and to stop it from committing these atrocities?
Well, I think this is one of the great mysteries, in a way, of this horrific genocide, which has got a kind of medieval flavour to it. This is supposed to be a civilised democracy. Actually, what they're doing is they're behaving like barbarians, and they are absolutely failing to learn any of the lessons that we just had last week from the 80th anniversary of the Second World War. I mean, any of the lessons. So what we're seeing now is not just concentration camps, is we're seeing death camps, exactly the same system that the Nazis used on actually a much bigger scale against a specific race. Hence, it's a genocide. So the question is, why are the Western governments going along with this? And I think the answer is that it's not just a medieval style crusader state that has been created in Israel, in the Middle East, but it's also a sort of medieval style of government that's starting to take hold here in the West, really ever since, I suppose, the 9/11 attacks, the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, but particularly since the accession of King Charles. He's, for example, had the nuclear force chiefs from the British Army and the French Army sitting with him in Windsor Castle. This is the sort of thing that the former Queen Elizabeth would never have done. She didn't take these sorts of, although she was commander-in-chief, of course, as well, she made sure that decisions like this were firmly laid in the hands of elected officials. And the idea of a monarch in our country is supposed to be that they can intervene to sort out a constitutional crisis if necessary, but generally hands-off. The trouble is with King Charles is he's taking a very hands-on approach. In fact, the only statement I can see that he's made specifically about the conflict on one side or the other, has been to condemn Hamas as terrorists. Now, we know that the actual terror is coming from over the last 80 years or so, has been coming from actually from Israel. So we have a kind of despotic rule. And you know what? I think people in the Middle East can see that Britain is starting to behave constitutionally rather like the Gulf states, like Oman, Dubai, and Saudi Arabia. And that's why I think they're supporting each other, because this is a criminal class, and they are looking after their friends in other parts of the world.
Okay, stay with me, Tony.
On their own population.
Stay with me, Tony. Let me get Mick back in on this conversation. Well, Mick, I mean, do you remember this time last year when the U.S. said it was building a pier so it could get supplies into Gaza, that Washington made it seem like it was such a priority for it to get aid into Gaza? I mean, what happened if the priority was actually getting aid to the people of Gaza, that it's not even being mentioned or nothing is being done right now?
Well, thank you for reminding me about that, because the developments have been coming so fast and furious that even with rising famine, I had forgotten about that gambit by the Americans to build a pier, which was suspicious all along. And it may have been really built for a military use, or it may have been built because Netanyahu does want Palestinians to leave Gaza in large numbers as quickly as possible. So it was a peculiar and a curious thing, and I've never really got to the bottom of it. But it's clearly pretty sick. It's clearly pretty sick in that situation and in the situation that we're in now. I guess I would point to one thing, that yes, the naked, open exhortation to famine sometimes. I mean, the British Prime Minister Starmer said Israel has a perfect right to deny water to the people of Palestine, of Gaza. And if water is life, then that means Israel has a perfect right to deny life to all the people of Gaza. So you sometimes have this open exhortation to genocide, and sometimes it's just a diplomatic silence. But the complicity is very clear, that while the regime in London is silent in atrocity after atrocity, now with rising famine, the beginning of the appearance of photographs of very, very emaciated children and adults, that there will be a price to pay. The price for the Palestinians, of course, is extermination. But the price for these regimes is incalculable as well. Because since 1945, not before, but since 1945, the West has presented itself, portrayed itself, and some of the leaders actually believe it possibly, as the defender of human rights. That white people in Europe and North America are civilized, superior to the rest. Now, the reality, of course, is utterly different to that. But this ideology was very strong because there was massive indoctrination from the early years of school through the mass media, universities, and so on. This took a hold. And it's now being shattered, because it's very clear that many, many millions of people can see that the barbarians are not at the gate. The barbarians are in the government. And what's more, always have been. Genocide is as British as apple pie is American. Britain has committed many genocides, but somehow they managed to conceal this. You speak to 100 people in the street in London or Glasgow, none of them knows that Britain was responsible for the death of 3 million Bengalis in 43 or 44 by deliberately taking food from there for the
British military. That's an interesting point you just made, Mick, and perhaps this, what we're at least seeing, unfortunately, this genocide will go not only to expose the Zionist regime, but its supporters in systematically supporting genocide, not only in Gaza, but elsewhere. I mean, Tony, if the regime cannot be made to end this siege, which of course it could be, whatever happened to the food aid drops that the U.S. was also insisting upon at one point in time? We're saying that people are starving to death, there's no food, there's no water, there's no medical aid. Of course, they could easily make the regime open up the gates. But regardless of that, why aren't they doing the airlifts that at one point in time they insisted upon doing?
Well, that's an excellent question, because actually the need for medical supplies, particularly food and water, are even greater now than they were back then. So there are, of course, many militaries around the world that could quite easily get this aid in, maybe reverse a few of the between 3,000 and 5,000 lorries of aid that are waiting to get into Gaza right now, reverse a few of those to a nearby airfield, and load them into the back of a transport aircraft with parachutes on, they could go in there. Or maybe even just bulldoze a hole in the wall and let it through that way. Because this seems to me amazing and unbelievable that the combined militaries of the world simply cannot bring themselves to do that. It's incredible. And actually, of course, we've done it before. Let's do it again. But look, I'd just like to disagree with Nick about we. This is not we doing this. In fact, I think many people in this country are very much aware of particularly of Britain's genocidal history, the attitude of the Royal Navy through history, turning up at capitals around the world by sea and using their cannons to intimidate and shell. They are aware of that, but this has got nothing to do with the British people, actually. Really, it's nothing to do with us. So this is a tiny elite, and they are concentrating their power. As I said again, we have no democracy whatsoever left here in the UK. We have a supine prime minister that does everything he's told by the royal family and the civil servants. And literally, that is why he's managed to get into that position. And we've got this across much of the Western world. But yes, of course, it's easy to get that food in. If you were to go to an RAF station and quietly ask pilots, would you be up for that? They, of course, would say yes. The reason it's not happening is the Commander-in-Chief, King Charles himself. He's the one that needs to do that from the British point of view. And, of course, there's no reason why the Chinese, who sign up, a major superpower, that they are one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council too, couldn't do exactly the same. So I'm really rather disgusted to see my own country, but also other major powers in the world are refusing to help these starving people, which they very easily could do. And it's not as if they don't know. The whole world knows what's going on in Gaza.
Okay. Right, indeed. Well, Mick, I mean, the Zionist regime seems to be using Gaza as its testing ground, from using all types of illegal weapons to various forms of torture and killing. And if one of them, of course, being the starvation, the regime seems to want to see how much it is allowed to get away with and how far it can go. Your thoughts on this? I mean, do you see this as a testing ground and basically just seeing will there be an entity that's going to stop it? Or basically, can they just kill 2.5 million Palestinians?
That is the question you've set us to discuss, and it's a very difficult question indeed, because the appalling prospect appears that the genocide may be, like many other genocides, successful. But I never at any time suggested that the British public were in support of the genocide or were in support of the crimes of the elite. In fact, the Zionists are very well aware of the gulf between popular opinion in, for example, Britain or France or Italy, and the policies of the government. A previous Israeli ambassador to London sounded the alarm many years ago, before he was promoted to the UN, Prosor, to say that public opinion was extremely hostile to Israel and this was a serious problem. No, that is the reality, and that's been the reality for several decades. It wasn't true in 45, but it's been true for about 20, 25 years. And what your other speaker says is true, that in the same way that Israel, Palestine, could easily absorb the return of every single Palestinian refugee, because it's got that record. Israel has a ministry of absorption. It can bring in large numbers of people, house them, only if they're Jewish, though, not if they're Palestinians. The only barrier is the intense racism of the government. And the only barrier to the quick relief of the impending famine is the genocidal intent of the Israeli government and the complicity of other regimes in that genocide. So that's the stern reality. The problem is for the Israelis and also for Trump, and Trump is beginning now to, I think, to tire of Israel. You know, he's negotiated directly with Ansar Allah in Yemen. He's negotiated the release of an American hostage by the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, without consulting with the Israelis. So He's not a solid ally of the Zionists. He uses them for his own purposes as they use him. So there could be a breach in that genocidal alliance, which would be very significant. And I think the key thing is the fear. When Trump goes to the Middle East and meets with his clients from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, they still fear their own public opinion. And if they're seeing Biafra-style pictures coming from Gaza, that's an acid eating away at the stability of these regimes. Because so far, they've stuck with America, they've stuck with Israel, while their populations can switch on their TV and see in press TV and many other channels the murder of people in huge numbers because they're Arabs or because they're Muslims. It's there for the world to see, and it's there for people sitting in their homes in Riyadh or Cairo to see. But if this develops in the direction it's going into full-scale famine, then that will cause problems for America's Arab clients in the region, and they may decide to instruct Israel to call a halt. I'm afraid that's the only short-term hope I can see, plus the Yemeni resistance targeting Israeli ships. But the short-term future looks exceedingly bleak, and I think we have to recognize that.
Okay. Well, Tony, would you say that one reality which has been exposed with this genocide in Gaza is that the whole Western facade has been removed, all the masks are off, and the ugly reality is shining through that it is might which makes right, not human rights?
Well, I think much of the world has seen that. I'm not so sure that the Western world, Europe and the United States, so much has, because of the control by the mainstream media. I mean, for example, this program we're on now is blocked and banned in the UK. So although much of this is known by the rest of the world, the idea is to keep the population in the dark in many parts of the UK and other parts of Europe and the United States. I think one of the most important, that hasn't really been properly understood in the world, this, is that the Israeli and Zionist lobby has a much wider plan than just this genocide in Israel. For example, they are trying to start a war right now alongside Modi and the Indians, helping the Indians to do drone strikes into Pakistan. Now, this is a kind of extension, in a way, of the Zionist-Islamic war that they're trying to cook up in the Middle East. We've seen the similar sort of things going on in Myanmar, too, with the Saudis supporting the Rohingyas and the government there being supported by Israel. So they are trying to start and foment trouble. So the idea is that you have economic difficulties. The Israelis will come along and say, look, here are the weapons to strengthen your regime and also possibly to gain resources and gain territory. But this is a recipe for World War III. This is a global disaster that we're staring. So unless we sort out this situation in the poor people of Gaza, the world can do that. This is like a cancer. It's spreading around the world because every time a new weapon is tested by the Israelis, the Israel lobby succeeds, as it nearly did in Spain, using their friends in the Spanish civil service to try to continue the arms deal between the Spanish government and the Israeli weapons manufacturers, while the politicians and the people wanted it stopped.
Okay.
You can see there's actually a lot of tendrils out there in the civil services in the Western world, which are starting to become exposed. And so it has to be that we stop this genocide in Gaza, and we start to realize that this is not just about Gaza. It's actually about the Israelis trying to start a much, much wider war to draw the United States militarily into the Middle East again.
Indeed. Well, Mick, I mean, the goal of the regime and its supporters seem to be to kill the spirit of the Palestinians and the spirit of the resistance. Do you think that it can be successful in doing that?
By every yardstick, the Palestinians should have surrendered a long time ago. The power arraigned against them, America, the EU, Britain, Arab regimes allied with the genocidal state of Israel, the imbalance in power is unique in the whole history of asymmetric warfare, and still they resist. Today they negotiated with America. They didn't. They weren't defeated. You don't negotiate with people who are crushed. Britain didn't negotiate with the Nazis after 1945. They defeated them utterly, and they surrendered unconditionally. There is no unconditional surrender from the Palestinian resistance or from the Yemeni resistance and from other resisting elements around the Middle East. So no, I don't think they will crush the Palestinians unless they exterminate them to the last man and woman. Because never in the field of history have we seen such amazing ability. And the lessons of Gaza will be taught in staff colleges around the world, where a war that was seemingly impossible, and perhaps I certainly 2 years ago would have thought that this was completely impossible given the objective factors, the lack of jungle, etc., etc. But the Palestinian resistance is reverberating around the world. And I would just end, if I may, my own contribution by saying the Western governments are increasingly isolated around the world. The Global South is moving and watching what's happening in Gaza and drawing the appropriate conclusions.
Okay, I'm so sorry
but
to interrupt.
These regimes are also isolated domestically.
All right, and that brings us to the end of this program. Thanking you both for being with us. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all of you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. Well, this is Nahid, having the honor of being with you on another episode. And here with me, I have my very dear, a little sad-faced sister.
Assalamu alaikum.
Why is the lying face?
Oh my God. So you know I study. It's so tiring. At some point...
Studying is tiring.
Yes. But, you know, is it worth it? Like, is it really going to help me? When I was studying school, where in my life were those algebra formulas going to help me? And then now I'm university and I chose my major. And I'm still sometimes questioning myself. Is this academic knowledge even going to help me?
Isn't it?
Is it just a fake knowledge?
Have you ever answered this question yourself? What's your answer? That moment that you are so tired, like right now, let me be that voice inside you and repeat the same question and see what answer you're going to give. Does this going to university and academic education make you truly smart, make you a better person? Is it helping you?
Not really, but maybe. Let me check. I am studying about history, I'm studying about poetry, I'm studying English literature,
right.
So these are related to me, right?
Yeah.
Some poetry, some drama, some ideologies and all. Okay.
Sister, you're already mentioning different fields fields of education.
Okay.
So right now you have information about, let's say, 3 or 4 different fields of study. So,
But what if like my other friend, she's studying math.
Mm-hmm.
So mathematics... A part of it is computer and all. Is that going to help her in real life? Like, I don't
mean
a
job. Ask her.
I'm not talking about job and all, but I'm talking about, like, real life skills. Will it help?
We should ask her, I guess. Since different people, they take different things from education. Maybe we both enter a class, and after the same class, I mean,
yes.
We both register for, I don't know, a computer class, let's say.
Yes.
And after 1 month, you will just learn much more than me, Maybe I got nothing from the class. Maybe I was even tired and bored of entering. I regretted it. So that's why I say it depends from person to person. Okay. But the point is, I also agree that education is not enough. I'm also the kind of person who would say, I will not miss school. I'm not the one who would say, oh my God, I really like to go back to school, see my friends there. No, that time has passed.
Yes.
Alhamdulillah. And I don't want to go back. Why do I say thank God the time has passed? I think the reason is that we need to pass education.
Yes.
Education is crucial, is necessary, is essential for our life. But it is not enough. The reason I say I don't want to go back and I don't miss school is that, okay, that part of my life is already completed. I have other parts and other perspectives to go through. You know, there are too many other things to life than just simply going to school, being educated. We went to university, we learned the major, we got familiar with how to interact with people, with academic people, with instructors. And even with our friends who are getting older, who are now young people, not teenagers anymore. But this is not enough. How do you feel about this? About taking your own part, learning your own part of education, and then finding the other gaps in life.
So when I think about all these studies, I see that most of it is not going to help me in my real life. But yes, I cannot disagree. You are right with the socializing part. We see people.
We interact.
We seek knowledge. We interact, yes. And yeah, I pretty much learned. Yeah, I remember in my school, I learned a lot of life skills.
Yeah, of course.
Like I do not trust everyone, but also I know how to find a good friend. Meanwhile, I know there are good people out there. Yeah.
So you see, even time management is one of the things that we got from school and education.
Yes.
So let's talk about the difference between the school academic education and life skills and the, let's say, more applicable skills.
The real
that
knowledge
we can implement on our lives after a very short break.
I was too proud to see the truth and prostrate to you. Until I took the first step, and that's when you opened the doors for me. Now, Allah, I realize what I was missing by being far from you.
Welcome back, dear listeners of ARAB English Radio. We are talking about education. Something that, like Masuma at the beginning of this episode, many people are tired of. Many people are bored, simply frustrated with all the hours of just studying, reading books. And at the same time, many of the teenagers, I'm sure many of the students, might not be aware that this is also one part of the journey.
Indeed. You know, this new generation, especially now Gen Alpha, that is already growing,
yeah,
mashallah, they can clearly see that the study hustle is not the only way to success.
Exactly.
So I can clearly see that some people are very negative, exactly how I was negative in the beginning. I was so tired. But now that I'm thinking with a cool mind, I can see that it has helped a lot and it will help a lot. It is not only that, of course, not the old theories are going to be applicable in my real
yeah,
life.
Of course.
I don't need to know about who killed who in the history. I don't need to know what medicine do I need to mix to make, I don't know, smoke. But we all can have our own ideas and learn new facts.
That's the point.
In a class. Like, I remember my teacher might be teaching something, but I'm also learning something else. I am looking at her. I'm looking at how she's teaching. I'm also observing. Like, I'm observing. So we might learn life lesson by observing. So I think these life skills, most of them are not taught.
Yeah.
We got to learn them. We got to seek them. Or we got to study them. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of it is just by observing. When you look at the bigger picture, when you look and see, I think you can extract some ideas. Now, my words might seem very abstract, but take a break and think about it. I'm sure by observing and evaluating again, we can find the life skills,
yeah, exactly,
even in the through all these academic knowledge.
Exactly. And on the other hand, we need knowledge. Yes. Some part of the knowledge, some part of the things that we can name them as theories, even those theories, some of them were applicable. Some of them were the ground for us improving, for us just finding our major, finding our jobs. We are also recommended in the Holy Book of Quran we are also recommended in the Holy Book of Quran by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who mentions, Allah will raise those who believe and those given knowledge. Those given knowledge. It's not like we open our eyes one day and we are given knowledge, but rather it is the verse is talking about those who go for knowledge, who seek knowledge, mm-hmm. those who are after finding the knowledge. It can happen in the classes, can happen at the school, the boring time in which we are studying many subjects that some of them are not that much sweet and interesting for us. But at the same time, we are seeking knowledge. That knowledge, those theories can be applicable in life too.
Now that you mentioned the verse from Holy Quran, I should think like that. That yeah. not this knowledge means every type of knowledge that we're learning. I think some academic knowledge are just some pieces of papers, with the all due respect or disrespect. Some of them are not the divine knowledge that Allah told us to seek. I think for having a clearer opinion on this topic, we need to study more and delve that what did Allah mean by knowledge?
Exactly.
Because also Prophet has mentioned seek knowledge, seek knowledge. What is this knowledge? We're going to leave this up to you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So what do you think? Is Allah talking about the kind of knowledge that we achieve and we acquire at school, or should we go for life skills? Well, the point is, if you ask me, I will answer it this way, that we have two types of knowledge, the life skills and mm-hmm. the academic knowledge. Both of them have value to themselves. We need both of them to succeed. We need the knowledge of school. We, of course, need the information about our major to improve, to find a job, to be knowledgeable mm-hmm. in our field. But at the same time, I cannot just reject the life skills. We, of course, need them as well. What if I just go to universities and schools for many years, but still I cannot communicate with people, but still I have simple problems, even those simple problems in life. I cannot cook. What if I cannot manage my own life, my own time? You see, the difference is, the gap is big here. The yes. difference is a lot, but we still can understand and realize that both have values to themselves.
And when you were talking about graduating from university, what if we start graduating, like we as human people all be graduated, but not really educated?
Yeah, exactly.
Now that
that's
is a new,
point.
I'm sorry, that sounds scary, but we have seen people around us who are graduated
yeah.
with very high degrees and they might have PhD and all, but do they know anything about real life? Could they ever be source of peace to someone else?
Even if we ask this question from ourselves, what's one thing that the school never taught you?
Oh.
You know, we were just struggling in a rush to
yes.
study and to pass the tests,
uh-huh.
to just go to school, study, get good scores, come back, go for the next grade, you see?
Hustle life.
Yeah, and I didn't learn patience in my life. I used to just grow up simply passing everything in a rush. And little by little, by just being in the company of other people, by communicating, by being a social person, and by acting actively in the society, I learned that they have to be patient. Not everything is that assignment that a school teacher had asked us to go through, and we had to just prepare it till the due date. And there are also many other examples. It can also be the importance of forgiveness. At school...
Yes, no one taught me that in
yeah,
school.
Yeah, at school when we just... it was hard to forgive. Can you remember the examples of teachers? Sometimes they wouldn't just, they wouldn't even change their scores. That's why right now when I'm just scoring my students and evaluating their assessments, I usually give them the scores that I think will make them happy. Not that if they are going to fail, I will make them pass. No, uh-huh. not this way. But at least I know if one of those kids is sensitive over getting 20 out of 20, not 19, I will not struggle over just one score. Oh. I will write the score that is truly given to the student, but I will tell them that if this makes you happy, okay, imagine you got 20. I at least tell them this value of forgiveness and sometimes forgetting other people's faults.
One another thing that I guess I didn't learn in school that I wish they would teach us is how to choose friends. How to choose friends and
making friends.
I wish I could read my friends' faces by how they were being with me. I was a chatterbox. I was a talkative person. I was this butterfly girl. But of course, I'm not a match to every kind of personality. Mm-hmm, and right? I remember this one poor friend of mine, whom I guess she didn't really like me much, but she didn't know how to push me away, and I would only always stick to her. If we were taught, I could accept the fact that it is okay not to be accepted by everyone.
Yeah, you see?
Now, oh my God. Now, we can say partially school taught me, but that was an indirect lesson. That was a very, very indirect lesson.
And it wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough and it wasn't on time.
Exactly.
Like, I learned it now. Like, this friendship has ended maybe like over a decade now. But if I knew this sooner, I would be less burdened on her. I wouldn't blame her. Yeah. I wouldn't be sad for no reason.
So you see, like different halves of a circle, this life skill and the academic education are complementary. They are completing each other. They are the things that will make our life meaningful. And without either of them, we cannot claim that we are leading a correct way of living.
Academic knowledge is important, but this is not enough. We should look what Allah meant by knowledge. I'm sure this is something much deeper and more beautiful that will guide us toward His holy way. That's enough for today. We'll leave you with knowledge. I hope so.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan.
On the western side of Naqsh Jahan Square, you find an exquisite palace which is known as Ali Qapu. It was built during the Safavid era and it was considered the political center of the country.
Ali Qapu literally means Great Gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels and just saw the amazing decorative artwork, and then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall.
One of the main attractions of Naqsh Jahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works.
Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles.
Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square.
The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's so big and colourful. Yeah. And what else, Dan?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they? Yeah.
You can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
What fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally, it's a unique work. You don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great. In terms of ornament, what fascinates me most is the interplay of natural tile colors with various sorts of blue color in these in the whole composition. The composition of natural tile color with blue, that's unique and that's very nice.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar.
The Bazaar of Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go.
probably one of the most interesting parts of Naqsh-e Jahan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Naqsh-e Jahan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long.
The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants. But it is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, Nowruz was celebrated, and polo games were played.
Now, after seeing all of these amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Naqsh-e Jahan Square must be on your bucket list.
Gisu Misha Ahmadi for Iran.
Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes. Bienvenidos a una nueva emisión de La Hora de Irán. Es un placer estar con ustedes. Bueno, como siempre agradecemos a todos los que nos siguen en cada programa y a quienes se unen por primera vez. Así que no se despeguen de la radio. Para empezar, escucharán una conversación que aborda temas interesantes sobre Irán. Esta vez, en una interesante tertulia abordan variados temas sobre Irán, como su idioma, milenaria cultura. Así que vamos a escucharlos.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. En el nombre de Dios, el misericordioso, el clemente. Muy buenas tardes, queridos amigos de habla hispana, hermanos de América Latina. Nuevamente, su fiel servidor, Eduardo Castillo Ortiz, desde aquí, desde la República Islámica de Irán, provincia sagrada de